You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
We were told that we would be able to poke our heads out a submarine and see the Statue of Liberty.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Valeri was a Soviet Navy diver sapper and was born and raised in Kiev, Ukraine. I've used a human translator for this episode, so the main voice you will hear is my translator, Galina Ryabova, who was kindly funded by one of my financial supporters. Valeri opens up about his childhood, the impact of the Great Patriotic War on his family, and his mother's resilience in raising him after his father's untimely death. He shares insights into his schooling, where history and geography sparked his curiosity, and his early military training, which set the stage for his specialized role in the Soviet Navy. Valeri offers a rare glimpse into the life of a Soviet Navy diver sapper, trained in both underwater firearms and explosives, tasked with clearing mines to pave the way for naval infantry. Reflecting on the broader scope of the Cold War, Valeri discusses his perceptions of the US and NATO, the political climate under Gorbachev, and his personal aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. I'm delighted to welcome Valeri and Galina to our Cold War conversation. Valeri, can you tell me where you were born and where you lived?
Валерий, скажите, пожалуйста, где вы родились и где вы жили?
Я родился в городе Герои Киеве и всю жизнь прожил здесь.
I was born in the hero city of Kiev. And I've lived here all my life.
Who was in your family?
I had a pretty large extended family, including aunts and uncles. But my immediate family was mom and dad. My dad passed away when I was 7 years old, and she was the one who raised me.
What did your mother and father do for employment?
My dad headed a leisure club, and my mom worked at a bread factory.
Did the Great Patriotic War impact your family much?
Yes, it was. One of my grandpas was fighting in the war, and he was injured in the Battle of Sebastopol. And the grandfather from my mother's side, we're missing him. There isn't quite any information about him, and I'm still trying to find him.
Were there any Communist Party members in your family?
Those who joined the Communist Party were people who were primarily interested in advancing their political career or becoming a high-level bureau. But those who were not interested in those things didn't want to join the party. Oh, correction. My grandfather was a member of the party because he was an officer.
What was your parents' view of the Communist Party?
They were pretty much indifferent. They had no opinion.
What was your schooling like?
I went to school number 91, and in modern equivalent, I would say it was an elite school. At that time, there were no elite schools. I was just going to the school in the same district where I was living, and that's why I was going there.
What was your favorite subject there?
History, geography, that was interesting.
Just like me, Valeri, my two favorite subjects as well.
They say that a Soviet school child could use a map to navigate back home from anywhere in the world.
I'd struggle to find my way home from school, I think.
Probably you were not taught the right way.
Yeah. And who were your friends at school?
I had friends from a class, a younger class and older classmates. And then basically we were friends, people who lived in the same district. And we also hang out after school. We used to play basketball together, for example.
Did you have any military training at school?
I stayed at school up to the 8th grade, but the early military training started in the 9th and 10th grades. So I had left the school by then, and I took the military training when I was already in college.
And what did you go to study?
I was learning to become a handyman for industrial machinery.
And what was the military training that you had at college?
Well, there was a lot of physical activity, like gym activities. We practiced to disassemble and reassemble a gun. We trained on how to act during a chemical attack or a nuclear explosion or fire attack. It was mostly a high-level training on those behaviors and those situations, focused on safety, getting to safety, while two countries exchanged rockets during the attacks.
And was that training with the DOSAAF? The DOSAAF, or DOSAF, was a paramilitary sports organization in the Soviet Union.
It was initial diving or elementary diving training.
And was that done at college, or was that done after he left college?
It was towards the end of college, and just about when I started, when I joined the workforce, I attended the training for about 6 months.
And what was your first job when you left college?
Those colleges used to train you for specific factories or plants. So I worked at a factory called Arsenal.
Right. And so this diver training was specifically around part of the job, was it? So this was like a hobby or just something that Valery was interested in?
Well, DOSAAF had different paths of training. Some people would be trained to use the parachute, others to use the radio. There were those who were trained to dive. And I was offered to join the diving training.
Did you have any choice of what your preferred role was?
My choice was, or the option was, that I would become a diver or I would join some naval forces.
Did you know what to expect as a conscript? Did people tell you stories about what happens as a Soviet conscript?
Our teacher in DOSAAF talked about the special forces, which were the equivalent of the US Navy SEALs. And I thought that's where I'm going to be conscripted.
I was more asking about, you know, what life was going to be like as a conscript, about treatment by other conscripts and officers.
Yeah, we were taught about the importance of the physical fitness. So I stopped smoking. I also was attending wrestling classes. So I was preparing myself physically. I was excited, especially that we were told that we would be able to poke our heads out of a submarine and see the Statue of Liberty.
Wow. Wow. That would sound exciting.
Yeah, those were the fables, the stories.
Can you describe your first day as a conscript?
I remember everything that happened, but I want to tell you how it happens. So on the first day, all the new conscripts are brought together to a special center, like a dispatch center. And there will be some military recruiters who will then come to the center and review the candidates and select from those candidates and then dispatch them to different destinations. And then we came to another distribution center near Sebastopol, and it was called Ekipaj. It was, again, a distribution center from where conscripts were dispatched to different military bases throughout the USSR.
When you arrive at your base, what's the initial training like? Can he describe that?
Actually, I ended up going where I wanted to be. Naturally, I was very curious, so I was asking a lot of questions about different opportunities of where I could get in. But the officer who was in charge of dispatching didn't have complete information. So he told me about the special Navy forces, which was Navy infantry. And he said, typically the conscription would be 3 years, but this one specifically was for 2 years only. So he told me about it and I thought about it and I agreed. Eventually, I ended up going to a diving school near Sebastopol. And during the first, we just had to run a lot. We ran very fast and we ran a very long time.
So your preparation for conscription paid off then?
I wasn't quite ready to run this fast. Just to compare the level of difficulty of this training, I looked at how Navy SEALs were trained in terms of running, and it seemed that they were not running as much as we did.
What was the food like? Did they treat you well?
When I talk about my food or what I was eating when I was in the Army, I often get asked jokingly if I was serving at somewhere at a general's dacha or general's townhome.
So the food was good, yeah?
It was excellent. Oh, we had plenty of cheeses, meats, cold cuts. It was wonderful.
Do you think that was because you were in a specialized role and not in infantry, for just regular Red Army infantry, for example?
This was the norm for those who were training to be divers. They were also divers, deep water divers, meaning they would dive a depth below 70 meters. They had even more food.
What weapons were you trained on?
It was a standard AK-74 plus some underwater weapon.
What was that? A mine? An underwater mine or explosive weapon?
We learned both the underwater firearms and explosives. So I learned how to be a sapper as well.
So were you training to attack like ships in harbor or something like that? Was that one of the missions that you might have been asked to do?
We had military training that would teach you the tactics and the strategy. So they taught us how to use equipment. They prepared us physically, because 2 or 3 years is not really enough to become a professional military person.
Can you describe the underwater firearms that you mentioned? How did they function?
Well, you can look it up in the internet. There are plenty of videos and photos describing their functionality. So there was a machine gun APS and a handgun PP1. It was different from what the U.S. Navy uses, because the U.S. Navy doesn't have the underwater machine gun.
Yeah, I was asking, because I'd not heard of an underwater machine gun before, but I will have to rush off and look at those videos now.
Yeah, but if you like, I will be happy to share some links or send you the photos and descriptions so you'll have a better idea.
That would be great, because I will then add those to the episode notes so listeners can see those as well.
The underwater world and the underwater warfare is very varied, so there is a lot of variety in it. And there used to be a lot of movies about underwater fighting or underwater warfare, but they all kind of disappeared at the end of the 50s, around 1956. There were some movies that I recall were The Waves Above Us or The Invisible Enemy.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Did you have any ideological training or ideological coaching around Marxism, Leninism, or anything like that?
There was a class called Political Information. It was more of an update, news update, just sharing the global news, what was going on around the world, the most recent negotiations or talks, and overall the situation all across the world.
What was the equipment like you were using? Was it good quality?
The equipment that you have in military and training schools is exactly the same as is present in military bases. The difference would be, for example, the underwater trawler had batteries of lower capacity as compared to real life equipment, so that you wouldn't be able to use it for long distances.
Okay, and the underwater trawler, was that something you rode on, or what was that?
Some of them were, for example, called Triton Prote. It was an equivalent of the U.S. trawlers called Pegasus. You may have seen them in old James Bond movies. So basically the way it works is you kind of lay down inside of it, and then it sails.
I was going to say, this does all sound a bit James Bond, what with underwater machine guns and vehicles to ride on.
And it's the same, exactly the same is true for the US or France or, you know, any other European naval forces.
Just the first time I've interviewed somebody who's in this sort of role before, but fascinating information from Valeri.
If you're interested to learn a little bit more about history of naval infantry, you know, in other countries, they started developing mostly after World War II. In Italy, it was a little earlier. It was after World War I. But there is plenty of information about history of these forces.
Thank you for that. So where did you go to after your initial training?
As I mentioned earlier, I was always very curious and was asking a lot of questions, and I ended up going for a two-year training instead of the standard three-year training. So when I completed that training, I went to the Baltic Sea to serve in the Baltic Sea.
Where was that?
Near Kaliningrad, former Königsberg. It was a tiny town, and our Navy engineering unit was stationed there.
And were you now a diver sapper, or was there further training that you needed to have?
That's correct.
What was your daily routine like in that role?
Well, it was already 1988, and those were the years where the CIA was successfully following its secret mission to dismantle the USSR. So the training or day-to-day life was the physical training, some shooting practice, It was mostly focused around guarding and surveillance. And every half a year, there would be training gatherings, like mass training.
So these are like military exercises. Yes. And what tasks did you carry out on these military exercises?
Dismantling explosive devices underwater to clear the passage for infantry.
Okay, so sort of like remove minefields and other explosive devices.
So during the military actions, typically the coastal line is protected by mines. And the job of a sapper, our job, was to clear, to remove that, let's say, a section of those mines, so that to clear the passage for the Navy SEALs to enter. So the Navy SEALs, as well as the equipment, to enter the shore, to cross the shoreline.
Were there many different nationalities?
Of course, there were people from different backgrounds, nationalities. We, in different units, would often have their own lingo. And sometimes you would forget the typical words for certain things when you got used to that lingo. Nationality-wise, we had Ukrainians, Russians, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Armenians, Azerbaijani, Lithuanians, and Latvians. We typically did not have any Estonians.
Was there a problem with people not being able to speak Russian to a sufficient standard, or could everybody speak Russian in some form?
No, there were no difficulties at all, no problems.
I mean, were you allowed to speak, for example, Ukrainian in the Russian army, or was that sort of frowned upon or not looked at as a positive thing to do?
Yeah, of course, we could just play around and speak some words in Ukrainian. We used a lot of words from Uzbek language. As I mentioned, we had our own lingo in our unit. And quite often, people who were in other units did not understand our language, our lingo.
So if somebody was transferred into your unit, they would have to take some time to understand the words that you're using, because you'd be using different words to what their unit used.
Yeah, it was pretty easy to catch up, because there was constant communication. And maybe if I was in an English-speaking environment, I would be able to speak English now.
You mentioned before about being trained in underwater weapons. Were you expected to have to potentially fight against NATO divers underwater?
Well, this is something that those who went to the 3-year training would do. They would participate in active warfare, fighting against those divers. Because I went to the 2-year training, my training consisted of engineering mostly, and I was prepared to be a Navy infantry engineer. And our work consisted mostly in dismantling the threat or clearing the shoreline. So as I mentioned, you know, the shoreline would be protected with explosive devices, mines, underwater mines. And it was our job. We were trained to dismantle those to clear the passage for the Navy. That's what we were trained to do.
Did you communicate much with your home while you were away?
Yes, we used mail. We called each other because there was no internet at that time. So yeah, we communicated a lot. We kept in touch.
And what did you do in your leisure time?
Well, in my personal free time, I would write letters. I would go to the library. I tried to learn English. And there were other activities available for us, such as movies, for example.
And were they allowed out of the barracks into the local town or anything like that? I know in East Germany, a lot of the conscripts were generally kept in barracks, but were they allowed out?
We had weekend leaves or family leaves if a family visited someone. And I know for a fact that in Eastern Germany, they had the same privileges. They could have a weekend leave. They could leave the territory of their barracks and go in the city. There are even photographs of Soviet soldiers walking in Berlin and other cities. So you must have been misinformed.
When you were with your other comrades in that downtime, what did you talk about? Did you talk about America or other countries? Did you discuss things like that?
Well, the subjects or things that we talked about were girls, life back home, our routine in the unit. As far as America is concerned, we were not very interested in it.
So did you consider America and NATO were a threat to the Soviet Union and were going to attack the country?
Well, I was mostly interested in military equipment or technology. I subscribed to some magazines, but military politics is like chess. So every figure has a move and they move for a certain reason, not just for fun. And that's how I approached this.
Did you think a war would happen at some point or was likely between the Soviet Union and NATO?
Well, it wasn't quite that I believed or somebody believed that it was possible. It was rather the sense of excitement that something may happen, an interest to find out who is better prepared or better trained if this happens. Because when a soldier is trained, they don't apply what they're trained on. It just the soldier gets bored. So whenever there is a sign of a war or conflict, you kind of get excited about it.
Did you have access to a TV in your base? And did you watch any Western TV?
Well, I did have a television. Of course, in those times, there was no cable TV. It was an antenna TV. So whatever the range of that antenna was, that's what we were able to watch. So it was a pretty limited range. And sometimes we were able to watch some Polish stations, but that was about it.
In your military career, did you experience dedovshchina? I think it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
You're smiling.
I know that it speeded things up in terms of learning reflexes. I also know that in some military bases, I've heard that there was extreme hazing, which was, you know, had negative impact. But the kind of hazing that was in our unit, it was all targeted around making people think and react and learn faster. So it was actually beneficial for soldier training. And I think that if you recall the movie called Full Metal Jacket, you will be able to see something similar happening there.
Yeah. Could you give me some examples of the sort of hazing that you saw in your unit?
For example, younger conscripts or newly drafted conscripts would have to do more push-ups, run longer, they will have to do more squats. So basically they were made to work harder during the physical training. In my experience, when it happened to me, when I just joined the unit, one of the elders decided to test how well prepared I was, how good of a runner I was. And he actually was from a different unit, from Volgograd. And I know that they were not trained to run as much as I was. Anyways, he realized that I was very good and very fast, and I ran longer, and eventually he got tired and gave up on me. So that was just one of the examples of how it happened.
And what were your officers like in your unit? Were they good?
So there was a one barrack for unit, and our beds were in one level. Unlike when I was training, we had bunker beds, basically two-level beds. Here it was only one level. The conditions were good. It was always clean. We ate well. The unit was located in a very beautiful place. There was beautiful nature. It was good.
When did your service end in the Navy?
In 1989, after there was an order issued by the Minister of Defense about the demobilization, people were sent home very gradually.
Right. Was this as a result of an agreement between NATO and the Warsaw Pact to reduce the size of their armies?
No, it wasn't related. It's a regular thing that happens every half a year. And it depends on the need. So some people are released. So it's called demobilization.
What did you think when the Berlin Wall opened? Did you think that was going to affect you?
I wasn't giving it too much thought because I don't live in Germany. So it didn't really affect me, or it wouldn't affect me at all. I just think that people often don't understand what the actions will lead to. Everybody believed that once the wall is broken, or once the wall falls, everything is going to be wonderful. However, in real life, we know that Eastern Germany had a very hard time adjusting to the new order of life, because the way life was and the market conditions in Western Germany were completely different from the Eastern Germany. And the Eastern Germany was, dependent on the state. The lives of people were dependent on the state. So they've had a very hard time adjusting, and Western Germany didn't really treat them that well. And in fact, Gorbachev betrayed the Eastern Germany.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
Did you think that Gorbachev was doing the right thing in terms of trying to reform and improve life in the Soviet Union?
Well, in essence, he sold the country out. I believe that he did not improve anything for the Soviet Union. The only thing he improved were the conditions of NATO and the West. And in fact, he destroyed the country. And he sold it out in exchange for cushy life in Germany and the funds he received from Germany, where he spent the rest of his days.
So how did life change for you with the fall of the Soviet Union?
For example, you have a home where you are well taken care of. And one day you wake up, you have no home, no food, nowhere to go, and no prospects. And you have no idea of what to do next.
So did it feel like you'd lost the Cold War, that the Americans and NATO had won?
Yes, I do. I even have a U.S. medal for Cold War victory. I purchased it because I collect medals, and I was curious to see one, because people didn't believe we lost this war. And the most painful thing is that we lost not the actual warfare, not in the actual battle, but the war of bureaucrats and politicians.
What was your best memory of your service in the Navy?
Well, my most fond memories are from my two-year training in Sebastopol. I remember those times. It was 1988-1989, because during that time, the focus was not so much on military training. We had to do a lot of cleaning work, a lot of construction work to participate in those types of activities.
Okay, and you're probably expecting the next question, but what was your worst memory of life in the Navy?
Well, one of the saddest memories was that when I was conscripted and they brought us to this dispatch center, there were some officers in the room who asked me where I wanted to go, where I wanted to serve. And I told them that I wanted to be a diver, and everybody just laughed. And if I had known then what I know today about how to play the system, how the system works, they would be the last to laugh, because I would have written a report to the leadership about it, and then they would definitely not laugh anymore.
Valerie, is there anything else that we've not covered that you'd like to share with me and the listeners?
Things to talk about, for instance, after my service, I wanted to pursue further training, either with the French Legion or the U.S. Navy SEALs. I would have loved to do that, because I already had a good foundation. But I wouldn't be able to do that financially, especially after the collapse of the Union, because my training was quite superficial overall. I have so many stories to tell, depending on what would be interesting to the listeners, because I had sad and happy stories, a lot of stories. So still a lot of information and stories. We can talk forever.
Could you tell me one of your sad stories?
So one of the sad stories or unfortunate stories that happened was in my first year of training. I was patrolling. I was on guard patrolling the park with a gun. And one of the elders asked to take pictures with a gun. So we took a lot of pictures. What I wasn't aware of is that the film was left in the camera. And sometime during the second year of my training, I was just about the end of that training. Again, I didn't know about it, but somebody in the unit started printing out the prints from that film, and they printed out in those pictures as well, where we were posing with a gun. And one of the elders saw these pictures, and we got caught. And basically, I was punished rather heavily for that. So that was not fun.
But tell me one of your happy stories, just to finish on a happy note.
No, okay. So there's a story. There were a lot of funny stories that were happening almost every day. So some of them may not be funny today. But one of the stories I wanted to share with you happened during my military training. When I was in training, there was a group of new drivers who arrived in the unit. There were people who were learning how to drive or training to be drivers for 6 months. And one day when there was a military alarm and readiness, we had to prepare very fast. We prepared the equipment, bullets, and had to load everything in the cars. But there were no cars around. They haven't arrived. There were no cars in sight. And we prepared the weapons, like I said, and equipment that needed to be loaded in those cars. And of course, there was a time limit when we had to load the equipment in the cars. And we were waiting and waiting and waiting. And eventually the officers ran off to the park and saw the drivers sitting in the cars and waiting. And it turns out that those drivers, when they were trained, when they were prepared, they knew how to drive, but they had no idea how to start the cars. So they were sitting, whenever they had their training, during the training, they would always get in a car that was, or a piece of machinery that was already started, and they would just drive off. They were not trained how to actually start it. So they were just sitting there and waiting in the cars. So that was the fun story.
Brilliant.
And that's when I realized, so those people were freshmen, they were new conscripts. And that's when I realized that the army, the way it was, doesn't exist anymore. Because these people were not interested in learning or doing anything. They were not interested in serving. Also, at that time, there was a fight against hazing. So the hazing was, they were trying to eradicate hazing. And all of this basically a signal to me that the army was weakened.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.